want to thank the organizers of this conference for inviting me. And I'm going to talk about the nonlinear dynamics of aluminum waves, mostly paying attention to a three-dimensional phenomena. And well, I'd like to start first with a few words concerning the onset of this work. I visited Frank Shu some years ago, and we discussed about compressible turbulence. And he more or less told me that, you know, once you add magnetic fields, all the problems you encounter to explain what happens in the interstellar medium disappear. And that basically, if you have supersonic subalvenic turbulence, you can explain the broadening of the lines without having to worry about too much dissipation, because there will be no shocks. And the main reason being that there are nonlinear aluminum waves that propagate, which are very nonlinear features, very stable, and do not steepen into shocks. Well, that was kind of a hard statement for me to swallow, but that started me on the research of this fascinating topic, because it's kind of a rich, very rich subject. And so I started reading papers on that field, and I then discovered that most of the literature was devoted to one-dimensional phenomena. Okay? Most of the literature on aluminum waves deals with the nonlinear stability of these waves in one dimension, basically because, you know, if you want to look at three-dimensional phenomena, you then require either a very difficult numerical integrations of the equations, or kind of more sophisticated analytical tools. So we started looking at this problem, having in mind that maybe three-dimensional phenomena could alter the picture quite a lot. And so my collaborators on this subject are Pierre-Louis Sudem first, long-time collaborator, and then students Stéphanie Champeau, basically, and now Dimitri Lavedere, who is pursuing his PhD right now on that subject. So what kind of motivation? So I then realized that in order to really study this subject in a way that do not really contradict the hypothesis of waves that are not too strong to destroy completely the picture of slightly gentle nonlinear waves, you have to study this field in a region where turbulence is not so strong. So there are several regions where this kind of work can apply. The first regions are solar wind and solar corona, and the second regions are the interstellar medium, the warm ionized state of the interstellar medium, mostly what Goldreich spoke about last time. So, you know, like the solar corona, you have this kind of observations where if you kind of model the picture a little bit, you end up having plasma in the corona that has at the base of the coronal holes, which are these open magnetic field lines, you know, more or less quiescent regions, a plasma where the density of particles is 10 to the 8 per cubic centimeter, temperature 10 to the 6 Kelvin, and magnetic field 10 Gauss, with a very, very small beta of order 100. Okay, and the amplitude of the waves is very tiny, also 100, basically, delta B over B. And so one of the big problems that I'm absolutely not trying to solve here is to explain the heating of the solar corona, and there are several schemes to do that. You know, basically dissipation of magnetosonic waves or shock waves that would only work, you know, in the chromosphere below. And so this is completely discarded in the corona itself. Reconnection at the base of the corona, which is one of the main explanations for the moment. And dissipation of aluminum waves, which encounter some problems. Basically, the problems that people have to put aluminum waves into the picture is that they are only efficient when they are nonlinear, and then they can steepen. And due to the fact that the field, the magnetic field, intensity decreases outwards, the delta B over B will increase and will become of order 1 only at 20 or 30 solar radii. And then when delta B over B goes to 1, you know, you can expect turbulence. And then you can expect heating, but not below. And Other people explain the contribution of Alvin waves by saying, well, if the medium is inhomogeneous, the shear can try to make the steepening of the waves and small scale formation and then plasma heating. Then we come here and say, well, actually, it's not really necessary to have inhomogeneities nor large amplitude Alvin waves. You can actually form efficiently small scales, even in a gentle, you know, very small amplitude waves and homogeneous medium by modulational instability. So that's the main topic of my talk. So I will skip. Okay.
But do you treat Alvin waves just as freely propagating when you gave us the estimate of 20 solar radius?
Yeah. That's basically based on the WKB approximation. So what are the equations we consider? So we consider a case where I can apply MHD, and I'm considering whole MHD, so which is one of the next approximation after ideal MHD, where I'm adding to the magnetic field equation a term that models the whole current. And this term is important because it brings dissociative effects into the picture. And so who says dissociative effect then says can have a balance between dispersion and nonlinearity, and then can have solitons and a lot of interesting features. So I will consider mostly whole MHD with a varying value of the dispersion. So the nice picture is when you have a large dispersion, then you can apply a lot of tools from asymptotic analysis, but I will explain what happens when the dispersion decreases.
Do you have some estimates about this coefficient Ri?
Yeah, I will come. I will come later in the talk to give you exact numbers in different media. So the equations have several parameters: the beta of the plasma, which is the ratio of the squared turn speed to the Alvin speed, and the polytropic gas constant that we consider here, which do not play any role for the moment here. And of course, this dispersive effect here, which is measured by the ratio of the ion cyclotron frequency to the non-dimensional frequency that is used to dimensionalize the equations. So, anybody interested in Hall currents? No. Well, this is one page of the Landau-Lipschitz book. Interested. So one feature of this equation is that it has exact solutions in the form of finite amplitude circularly polarized monochromatic Alvin waves. So that's the main feature, and it's a very important feature because it allows us to really go beyond the limit of asymptotic analysis. So you have an asymptotic analysis that we are going to explain in a little while, that is strictly valid given a certain range of parameters, but the fact that we have these exact solutions floating around allow us to really extend the validity of this approach. So basically, these waves were found by Ferro in 55 without dispersion. Well, it's a trivial matter to add dispersion. And you have these equations that describe, you know, the transverse velocity and magnetic fields, and no fluctuations of density or longitudinal velocity. So that's, of course, in a case where you have a uniform magnetic field B naught that permeates the medium.
Do you need a whole term to support this? It can happen without that, right?
Yeah, in 55 ton dissolutions without whole term.
And the amplitude is undetermined.
Yeah, that's the nice feature. I mean, as long as you have a balance between U grad U and B grad B, basically.
And they can still be finite amplitude.
Yeah. Even with this stuff.
Even with the amplitude being arbitrary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you find me, where you can present a linear polarized Alvin wave as a sum of different.
Yeah, but if you sum, then this is not a solution.
Yes. And why is this the case? Why not? Would you remind me? Why not? When you use linear polarized waves?
Basically, you need the B square to be constant. So in a linear polarized wave, you don't have B square constant.
Okay. Yeah.
So that it's really crucial to have this helicoidal structure. So I mean, so we have nice solutions, but I mean, nobody said that they are stable. So one of the main goals is to study the stability. So first of all, in the case of finite dispersion and weak nonlinearity, we can do analytic work because we can then use a multiple scale expansion to derive amplitude equations. So we suppose that we have a train of these nonlinear Alvin waves, you know, slowly modulated on long spatial and temporal scale. Okay, so we use a standard multiple scale expansion where you have two space variables which are scaled by an epsilon which measures the amplitude of the waves. And so we put this NZ into the equation, turn the crank, and then at the first order we get the linear problem that gives us the linear wave solution.
And I take it, can F, Y, G, T, they are epsilon X, epsilon Y, that is? Cap X, cap Y?
Yeah, they are. Here you have a small scale along the wave propagation, and only large scales perpendicular to that. Then here you get the Alvin waves as the solution of your linear problem, and then you have the nonlinear hierarchy of equations, which are all linear, with the same operator M naught and different right-hand side. So, of course, when you solve that, you have to satisfy solvability conditions on the right-hand side, that it has to be in the image of this operator, and that gives us amplitude equation. So a heuristic interpretation of the equation we have is that you replace the dispersion relation strictly valid in linear context with a nonlinear dispersion relation where you modulate the time, and so when you modulate time, you transform your frequency omega into omega plus d by dt, a slow time, and you modulate your k, your wave vector, and so you replace it by k plus some contribution from the large scale. Large spatial scale. And you have contribution from the transverse gradients, of course, and from mean fields, which kind of renormalize your frequency here. Okay, so this equation now is in Fourier space. You Fourier transform and you get the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, which is an equation for capital B, which here stands for the envelope of your wave. This is the multiplicative factor in front of the exponential of I kx minus omega d. So this equation is simply just the transport at dominant order, plus at smaller order, dispersive and diffractive terms, okay, dispersion in the direction of the propagation, diffraction in the direction perpendicular to the propagation, plus nonlinear terms. And so if you want to interpret a little bit these coefficients.
Diffraction is also dispersion, right?
Yeah, you have a diffraction tensor which contains both longitude and.
What exactly is the dispersion? Difference between dispersion and diffraction?
Well, diffraction is when you bend your fill your phase contours. You know, you have a reaction of the field amplitude to the bending. And diffraction is basically due to the dispersion. Sorry, is basically due to this whole term in the direction of. Propagation where the waves propagate at different velocities depending on the frequency.
In terms of transverse dispersion?
Yeah, transverse dispersion, yes, exactly. I mean, diffraction or transverse dispersion, exactly. Mm-hmm. So here is, after a systematic expansion, you get these equations, actually. So you don't get, you get nonlinear Schrodinger equations when you take the approximation that the slow fields, which I will explain a little bit later, are slaved to the Alvin wave amplitude, and then you get just pure Schrodinger equation. But otherwise, in a general context, what you get is the following. You get this equation, which is nonlinear Schrodinger coupled to the mean field here, and the mean field are the mean longitudinal velocity, the mean longitudinal magnetic field, and delta, which is a combination involving the density and the longitudinal magnetic field. So that's nonlinear Schrodinger, coupled to these three equations, which just are basically what? Slow waves, okay, here are the slow waves, driven by condensatic forces, so basically gradients of the envelope of your Alvin wave drive sound waves, plus a term here, which is actually quite non-trivial. You have to go to next order of expansion to get this term, and it's a crucial term, which corresponds to also a congruency force in the transverse direction, and which, when you rewrite the equation in a simple form, rewrites as dt plus vg dx of d squared. So it's a small term, which absolutely has no effect for strictly longitudinal perturbations. So if you consider a one-dimensional problem, this term cancels. But when you consider a three-dimensional perturbation and quasi-transverse perturbation, transverse to the propagation, then what happens is that this term becomes of the same order as the other terms. And that will be a crucial effect.
Will disappear, right?
Yeah, because you rescale the d by dx, actually. That's what happens. You know, if you don't have d by dx, it's very small,
yeah.
Then the term that counts is this one.
So is the whole effect appearing through vg prime?
The whole effect appears here.
Prime.
Okay, in the dispersion term. And it doesn't appear in the diffraction. So for perpendicular perturbation, you know, the whole effect has no doesn't enter directly the picture, but it enters indirectly, as we shall see. So if you are very clever, meaning if you know about Hamiltonian dynamics and basically are from the Russian school of Zakharov and Co.
That's what it takes to be clever.
No, but I mean, I could never really guess these things from first principle, especially in this case where I think we have a discrepancy with the Russian school, which. That's what I'm saying. If you are very, very clever, maybe you can guess it right. But it's kind of subtle. That's why I'm saying, well, this is just a very schematic way of understanding what happens. Okay, so all these equations have coefficients that you can guess from first principles, like group velocity. Okay, everybody knows omega prime. Dispersive term. Okay, you know that it's transverse gradient also of the frequency. Diffraction term here have to be careful because it's non-isotropic, so already you cannot use simple formulas like Vg over 2k. That doesn't work here because it's anisotropic, so you have to be careful when taking these derivatives here. And then potential, you know, if you know, for example, the form of the Doppler shift frequency, you can guess the form of the potential in the nonlinear Schrödinger equation by this kind of functional derivative here. And this corresponds here to what we obtain in the limit k goes to 0. And then finally, ponderomotive forces. This has attracted a lot of work in the plasma literature over the years. We get it directly from multiple state expansions, although we have to go to next order to get it. And so we get both a time dependence and a spatial dependence in the ponderomotive forces. And this has been the subject of a lot of work by plasma physicists because basically, because they don't use systematic methods to find these ponderomotive forces. Okay, usually they involve physical arguments that are not based on atomistic expansions and sometimes are difficult to get.
Why don't you get the Davis-Stirson equation?
Well, it's kind of a Davis-Stirson equation here. If you, for example, for this term here, if you take an approximation that dt is like vg dx, okay, you get exactly like a couple that it was an equation when you slave these slow variables here.
That can also be like Zakharov equations.
Yeah. Zakharov-Rubenchik equations.
Yes. And all of couple to.
This would be the Zakharov-Rubenchik equations, but we have an extra coupling here to the longitudinal field. And this coupling comes from the fact that you have divergence b equals 0, so you cannot get rid of that. But these two equations are kind of a generalized Davis-Stirson equation. So you just take the slaved formulation for delta and ux bar, put it back in here, and you get Davis-Stirson. So what can we do with this equation? We can study the stability. So it's a stability of long wave, so it's a modulational instability. And what we get is that when the beta of the plasma is larger than omega over k squared, which is roughly 1 for small k, which is the phase velocity of the Allman wave squared, then the instability regarding quasi-perpendicular perturbations is an absolute instability, meaning that it develops in time. So you have an Allen wave that, when subject to perpendicular perturbations, will become modulationally unstable. And I will describe this in great detail. But when the beta of the plasma is smaller than 1, then the instability is convective, meaning that it develops in space. So if you take, for example, at the surface of the Sun, you emit an Allen wave, you know, it propagates in the corona, and it will develop an instability as space, you know, grows. And after a certain distance of propagation, you will get also a transverse instability called also filamentation, but that develops in space, not in time. So, as I said, if you just slave the Allen waves, the slow waves to the Allen wave amplitude, then you get just non-linear Schrödinger equations with a diffraction term here and a non-linear term here.
So that the design of the transverse
doesn't
change depending upon the
Yeah, that's why you get this instability. Yeah. When beta is larger than 1, okay, this is negative. Okay. And that's why you get a stable case for now.
Do we move magnetic
field
lines or we concentrate energy?
So I'll show you just my next transparency. So this filamentation instability is called filamentation first because you have an Allen wave that propagates in a, for example, the x direction. You perturb in the y z direction. Okay, so everything depends on y z only. So if you get a concentration of energy or density, it will form like a filament. So imagine that you increase the density locally, density of the plasma. Then what happens? If you look at this formula for the Allen wave velocity, the phase velocity, it will decrease. So it means that if I increase the density locally here, the wave front will propagate faster on the outskirts than inside here. Okay? And so it will continue to bend like this. But the bending of the wave front leads to a focusing of the Allen rays, okay? Like this. And due to the diffraction term, the fact that the rays are bended like that enhances the transverse magnetic field. And due to divergence B equals zero, this has to decrease the longitudinal velocity, magnetic field. And if you look at that, this continues to decrease the Allen speed. And the Lorentz forces here will further confine the particle. Okay, and it's like, I mean, I say it's like a tokamak because you have a spiraling of the magnetic field. So they confine the plasma density here. And since I consider the case here where beta is smaller than 1, then the thermal pressure being subdominant with respect to the magnetic field says that I will continue to compress, and this closes the loop, and I will have an instability. So that's the case of the convective instability. In the case of the absolute instability, the only difference is that the density, instead of enhanced inside the filament, is rarefied. But I have velocity along the tube. So now I will have a tube that forms homogeneously in space, that forms in time. The plasma is rarefied, but I have a longitudinal velocity along the tube. So this works only in three dimensions, okay? In two dimensions, I only get modulation and instability that can lead to, for example, solitons, but not to collapse. Why? Because in the equation that we get is a two-dimensional nonlinear Schrödinger equation in the transverse directions. And we know that if we get a one-dimensional nonlinear Schrödinger equation, you don't get collapse, you just get solitons. So you need really a three-dimensional configuration for this to work. So now I'm going to the next part of my talk, which is to study this, both numerically and with simplified tools. So first of all, I would like to study what happens in the context where the wavelength of the Allen wave is long enough. And then this allows me to study these dynamics with a reduced model. Instead of taking the whole full MHD equations, I can consider a simplified asymptotic, which is called the long wave asymptotic, that will save me a lot of computer time. And the last part of my talk will be devoted to show that if I consider the full whole image equation, then I recover the results I just presented here with some cautions on some other instabilities that can exist. So what can I do to study this problem? I mean, I can study it within the context of the nonlinear Schrödinger equation, but it's not very useful because these equations have been studied already, and the assumptions that are made are that of very small amplitude, so it's not really the ones we want to make, and they don't provide a good coupling with all the other fields. So I will consider a simplified version of the image equation in the context of long wavelength asymptotes. So I think I can skip the linear waves here and show you directly the kind of asymptotics we do. So here it's not an envelope formalism, but it's a long wave formalism. So I scale the fields, okay, and the space and time using this kind of transformations. So here I have only one space and one time. I don't have multiple scales. So it's stretch variables and extension of the fields with a small parameter, which is the amplitude of the field, chosen in such a way that I select the Alvin wave. You know, I can then change this scaling here and select, for example, the magnetosonic waves. This will lead to another equation. But if I take this specific scaling, I get, in one dimension, a very famous equation, which is called DNLS, which is derivative nonlinear Schrödinger equation, which is, I say, a long wave equation for a complex field. B is a complex quantity, which is BY plus IBZ. And this quantity here obeys an integrable equation. This equation has been shown by Karp and Newell in 78 to be integrable in the scattering. So it has excited a lot of work in the solar wind community because this equation provides nice polyhedronic structures. But it's in 1D. And that's for beta different from 1.
So what you're doing is basically within time theory now?
No. Witham would be to. This Witham formalism would be to slave the amplitude to the phase and just look at the phase of the other wave. Here I'm considering both phase and amplitude. It's just like a long wave asymptotics. It's the kind of equation you get when you take, for example, water waves, and you get KdV, for example. But here I don't get KdV because of specific properties of these Alvin waves. I said they are, so I think I will have to go to this transparency. I think that you see here that I'm looking at the case where I propagate along the magnetic field, and I have three waves in MHD, the fast, the Alvin, and the slow. And along the propagation of the magnetic field, I have coincidence of the phase speed of the fast and the Alvin for beta smaller than 1, or the slow and the Alvin for beta larger than 1. And so the fact that I have two eigenmodes for the same eigenvalue leads to a degeneracy in the formalism. And so instead of getting KdV, which would be the standard equation, I get an equation for a complex field, which contains two quantities now, and this equation is DNLS. Okay? But that's really, you have to think about it as KdV. And if you consider, for example, the fast wave, then you would get KdV. If you consider the Alvin wave at a certain angle, then the problem is very degenerate. I won't have time to talk about it, but you get basically MKdV. So this was for in one dimension, but we're interested in three dimensions. So just to answer your question, you've seen here that for beta equal 1, I have a triple degeneracy now. The free phase speed become coincident for the fast, slow, and Alvin wave. And then in that case, you get also an interesting equation, which is basically DNLS coupled to a Burgostat equation for the slow wave. So now the slow wave is non-linear. Now you have a Rolle wave in the equation for the density. So it's just a comment on the specific case beta equal 1, which always stands out. So now, when the solution is not localized, when I do this kind of long wave extensions, I have to take into account slow fields. I cannot just assume that the wave is going to zero at infinity. I am considering a wave train. So I might have mean fields that float around. Okay? So I go over the technical details, but basically this mean field are coupled to the dynamics. And now the generalization, the correct generalization of the DNLS equations in three dimensions is the following. It's an equation that is an equation for dy plus ibz, this complex field, coupled to a mean longitudinal velocity and a fluctuating longitudinal magnetic field. So this mean longitudinal velocity plays a crucial role. I said before that in the filamentation process, in the absolute case, you have a longitudinal velocity in the plasma that starts to drive the flow. And so this you have to take it into account. And it's driven by mean terms. These mean values are taken over the longitudinal direction. Okay, so this couples into the relative nonlinear Schrödinger equations for this term. So the goal now is to perform numerics on this equation and to look at the nonlinear development of these instabilities. So now I come to answer your question about the values of the dispersive terms. So you have seen that there is a parameter nu which corresponds to the whole term in the equation. And this parameter nu, now I can give you numbers. In non-dimensional units, it's basically given by the ratio of the wave number to this Ri parameters times B0 squared. And in dimensional units, you get this quantity here, which is basically the ratio of the Alvin speed to the Ion 0 magnetic frequency. Lambda is the wavelength, and delta B over B minus 2 is the amplitude of the wave. So if you take the solar corona, for example, with these parameters, you get nu equal 1.9, so which is not negligible, which is not zero. And in the solar winds, further down, you get like 1.6 times delta B over B minus 2, which also can become relevant. We know that, you know, close enough to the Earth, you have strong dispersive effects in the waves that can be observed in the solar wind. You have Whistler propagations, a lot of dispersive effects. So this term is certainly non-negligible. This one from several papers by several authors. Mackenzie, I think, and a couple of other names. Yeah, it depends a little bit, but people think that the micro reconnection at the surface of the sun can drive high frequency waves, close to the solar wind. No, you cannot. I mean, what you see is much further away. But it's inferred by some people based on the micro reconnection network that is more or less observed at the surface of the sun. Of course, if you take longer amplitude waves, then this term drops. Okay, this amplitude, this term drops, and then we enter a case of very small dispersive effects, and I will show you what happens in that case.
If you want to
have a big term, usually you have to take down to the armor rays. Yeah. But you see that you have these terms here, the amplitude squared of the wave that.
How does the amplitude fit in there?
Yeah, because the equations are non-dimensionalized by the amplitude of the wave. Okay, delta B here. B is about a 1, basically, in my equation. Everything is about a 1, and I have a parameter here, nu, which then depends on the amplitude of the wave. I just take a non-dimensionalization of my equation so that everything is about a 1, and then I calculate what is the value of nu, and then in that case, of course, the amplitude comes into play. You know, you have a trade-off between the wavelength and the amplitude. You can consider long wavelengths but very small amplitude, and that's equivalent to short wavelengths and higher amplitude. So either you're talking about wavelengths close to the Armor ion radius, or you consider long wavelength Alvin waves, but a very, very tiny amplitude. And that, in the formalism here, is equivalent. The dispersive effect will come at the same level.
With these numbers for the solar corona that you gave, what is the typical wavelength?
So the typical, I'm talking about frequency here.
20 rads per second.
Talking about frequency, it's like 3 hertz. And I have 20 kilometers per second for the speed. So you have to make the conversion.
The wave of that frequency as a wavelength, a long wavelength.
Well, yeah, but I mean the wavelengths of the Alvin waves in the solar corona are supposed to be quite long. Hmm? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Huh? Excuse me. Yeah. So, you know, in order for this phenomena to work efficiently, I need to have nu over the 1. But if nu is smaller than 1, much smaller than 1, then, you know, I will get different phenomena than just filamentation. And I'll show you. This is not so dramatic, but this can drive quite a lot of turbulence at small scale. And still, the heating, we have evaluated the heating. On the long run, the heating is even more efficient in that case. So I'm not too concerned about that, but so what did we do? We followed the evolution of circularly polarized waves, slightly perturbed in the transverse direction. So these are the initial conditions, you know, no fluctuation, just a circularly polarized wave. And so before that, we studied the instability with respect to one and several dimensions. And so I'll skip the details here. And what we get is filamentation for this case. So I have a beta equal 3, and here I chose nu equal 50, you see, so I'm strongly dispersive here in that case. So I am exactly in the context of the formalism of nonlinear Schrödinger equations. So I should really obtain something that looks like the prediction of nonlinear Schrödinger, and that's what I get. So here is a three-dimensional picture of the magnetic energy, magnetic intensity, a cut at b squared equal 10. And here is a cross-section of this magnetic intensity. So I started with b equal 1, and I see filaments forming with b squared. This is b squared up to 100. So I have a factor of 10 amplification in the B, or 100 in the B, in the energy. And so these forms, these are typical structures that form in the flow, concentration of energy into tubes. Now what happens if I take nu equal 0.5? Then the picture changes dramatically. But instead of getting tubes, I get sheets. And these sheets are lower amplitude, but stronger gradients. So actually what we want for heating the plasma is very strong gradients. So actually these gradients are strong enough to excite you know, small-scale phenomena efficiently. So if you look at the amplitude, so the amplitude grows by a factor of 6, and the gradients here by a factor of 250. And if you look at the features, these sheets are elongated mostly, you know, along the film.
How much time is the tube now?
Well, I haven't really drawn a three-dimensional picture of the field. I should, but this corresponds to b squared equal 4, so it should be quite tangled because the field originally has an amplitude of b equal 1, and it's straight. And now I have, you know, concentration on this sheet, so that's one of the goals to perform nicer visualizations, but.
And what about these filaments? Are those like flux tubes?
So these tubes correspond to very intense spiraling magnetic field lines.
I see, so these are spirals?
Yeah. Well, helices.
Yes.
With a plasma which is rarefied at the center and the velocity and the stream velocity inside.
And they are stable, they are not making any motions.
Well, you'll see if you play a little bit with the parameters, you can modulate them, and they probably will become unstable later on. The thing is that Then when you get to these amplitudes and go back to the full equations, then you can form shocks, and this will help a lot to recreate also small scale features. So that's the next part of my talk. Just finally, for nu equals 0.01, very, very tiny dispersion, I get the more standard features of really like shock waves, you know, very, very, very steep gradients, but almost no amplification. I mean, it's very tiny amplification of the magnetic field. And this is to be expected, of course. So I remind you, I started with a uniform field and very tiny perturbations, and I just let the modulation instability go. So it means that in this context, I can get rid of all spatial inhomogeneities, I can get rid of any driving. The field by itself will develop these instabilities. No, because for beta less than 1, you would get a convective instabilities, and for the convective instabilities in numerics, is much more difficult to perform. Well, I tried to think about it, but it will require kind of a clever technique of storing your the information you need and then getting rid of it after a while. Yeah.
In this case, how long does it take to develop?
It's quite long because it's a modulation of instability, so in terms of...
Will the wave have gone out of the solar corona before it's gotten sick?
We have performed we have a paper in the APGA where we actually try to calculate the heating resulting from that, from arguments based on mostly non-Schrödinger equation which apply in this context. And then it turns out that the heating, most of the heating will occur within 1 or 2 solar radii, and so the length it takes to be modulation unstable, I would say, in the context of the solar corona, would be like half the solar radii. But you have plenty of these events scattered in space, so it's not at all, you know, so far from the base.
If you happen to just go to the solar case, this is more general theory, but you have a source of oscillation at 20 radians per second, then most of the loops in the solar corona will be almost resonant, and they'll have Dalcroze vibrations. The problem has always been, at least just from reading part of this book,
that
there's very little energy up at those frequencies.
Well. We don't require a lot of energy here, but what we that's what I'm saying. I'm not claiming to have a mechanism here, and this is more general than just solar corona. But
solar corona doesn't work there. It doesn't work.
I don't know exactly. I mean, we have a paper where we say it can work, but it requires more work to be sure that other phenomena will not interfere, but you know, I think this kind of features can appear, you know, elsewhere, like much further down from the solar corona, back in the main
you're
solar.
You're saying these sheet-like features appear in your calculations, and you're trying to, you're saying that the conditions are right in the solar corona for forming these features.
Yeah, in the solar corona, it's mostly sheets and not filaments. Yeah.
Okay. How thin are the sheets that you're able to predict?
Well, here in that case, they are very that they are at the scale, you know, of the computation. So in the context of in the physical
in the scale
context
of the computation.
Yeah, but in the physical context, there will be like the ion zero radius, and that's where you have cyclotron.
How do you get what gets you down to the ion gyro radius? Because I'm familiar with when you take these solutions and then you just do a 1D calculation across a sheet or something like that, that the magnetic pressure in the sheet itself is going to sort of prevent you from getting that thin. I mean, maybe you've gotten that thin in the calculation because there's some, sort of some external force in your calculation or something residual from your initial condition that's gotten you down to this one point. But to get thinner than that, you need something more to push it through, right? The mechanism that releases it in this case.
Remember that the field topology, I'm showing here the transverse energy, the field energy in the transverse component. So you have to add the longitudinal field. So the field topology is more complex than just these sheets, okay? First of all. So you're not pushing against magnetic pressure directly. And second of all, in the mechanism...
What are you pushing against then?
It will be like... in a slow wave, for example, okay? You can increase the density and at the same time decrease the field intensity by driving the flow almost like in a shear fashion, and you don't oppose magnetic field pressure.
Right.
In a fast wave, yes, but not in the slow wave. So
but that doesn't push them together just through the shear.
Well, not in the case of a shear, yeah. But in this context, what I'm saying, the topology is not like a field and a compression perpendicular to the field, because in this picture you still have to add the longitudinal, the main field component. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, this requires more visualization to kind of picture the kind of topology in the real world. I don't know exactly.
So
think it's a problem.
There's an extra component to the topology.
Yeah.
In the real world, where things are getting twisted around, that somehow gets you out of it.
Yeah, I think so. Problem. Because you know, in the instability process, I don't encounter the problem of magnetic pressure.
Okay.
On the contrary, I mean, the field spirals around my plasma, and so.
Well, I agree that's probably the way out, but what I'd like to see is somebody actually do that sort of hard calculation.
Mm-hmm.
You know. It's sort of analytic, but it's one level above it, so you might want a computer to help you out with it or something.
Yeah, I will definitely ask the student to perform very nice. that's one of the things. So,
but it's essentially really because of this Fortran. Without the Fortran, you wouldn't get that.
No.
Without
the whole term, this is one of the things I'm going to explain now.
Is the whole term coming in now, or has the whole term been in from the beginning?
No, the whole term has been there from the very beginning. The whole term brings this. The whole term brings distortion into the picture. Okay.
Right.
So in order to get a nonlinear Schrödinger modulational instability, you need distortion. But here it's a transverse instability, okay? So you can think of in terms of optics, for example. In optics, you get the same kind of filamentation process in a laser, for example.
Right.
And then you don't need dispersion to provide this filamentation. But in optics, the thing that saves you is that the waves are always very nicely linearly polarized in that case, or they don't suffer from instability at small scale. In the context of Alvin waves, what drives you from the filaments to the sheets when you decrease dispersion is basically the fact that the Alvin wave loses its circular polarization. Okay, and the circular polarization of the Alvin wave is maintained through the dispersion. So if you decrease dispersion, then the field doesn't have a tendency to stay circularly polarized. And in that case, instead of getting nice filaments, I get these sheets. So that's the process.
What's the scale on which the whole term comes in?
The whole term comes in at the scale of the ion Larmor radius.
Okay.
The thing that worries me about that is that if you get things on the scale of the ion Larmor radius, you get collision anyway.
Yeah, sure. But that's why I'm saying. I mean, this provides heating. The heating is not. I mean, I have no dissipation. It's a Hamiltonian system. Okay. But once I get to the small scales, then I cannot describe what happens with these equations. I will have to introduce some non-collisional damping, and this will provide
more heat. In order to make the whole term significant, you've got to already be on small scales.
Right.
On small enough scales, but not at the Larmor radius. I have a certain scale separation.
Well, just once you reach the collision, which is way before the.
I remind you, there is a trade-off.
The Larmor is kilometers, right? But the Larmor radius scale is.
But I remind you that there is a trade-off between amplitude. Yeah, but this would be true. I mean, if I had an amplitude of order one. I'm not considering amplitude of order 1 here. I'm considering small amplitude waves. Yeah, but the wave, the wavelength of the wave doesn't need to be at the ion armor radius. That's what I'm saying. That's what I told you before. There is a trade-off between amplitude of the wave and wavelength.
I'm saying you only have to be at the occlusion of that, which is about a kilometer of the corona.
Yeah, but the kilometer, my waves are much longer wavelengths. Yeah. So I'm not at this scale.
Well,
but
the ion armor radius is 10, a few centimeters.
I repeat the picture. I have a long wavelength so that I'm not worried by this non-continuous phenomena. Then I have this modulational instabilities that creates these small scales. Then when I reach these small scales, that's it. I stop the computation. I say I cannot go further.
You don't get modulation and stability unless you have the whole sound.
Within a kilometer already.
To make it significant.
No, because
the whole parameter mu is 1.5.
That's what I'm saying. The whole term will help you even if you have a long wavelength, as long as you have a small amplitude.
Only if you've got a long time.
You need a long wavelength, a long time, and a small amplitude, but you know that's.
So the question then is how long the time? Okay.
Well, I answered the question. I mean, like for the solar corona, it would be like propagation of a half a solar radian.
We can trust you.
Certainly, it's time to do that.
Well, I guess the quantitative alternatives are responsible for this heating activity, and some kind of a modulation activity for the alternative has to be in operation.
Well, there are other dispersive terms. I mean, I chose the whole term, but, you know, that's the choice.
Yeah.
But it's a very general feature. I mean, that's... here, you need dispersion, but since it's a transverse modulation and instability, it's not crucial. If I have very tiny dispersion, I will just change my topology instead of having cubes, I will have sheaves, but basically I will still have the modulation instability. No,
but then it's just the steepness of the arc.
Well, it's a little bit more than if you go to zero dispersion, yeah, it's just the steepness.
But that takes those amplitudes take the long way out, right? Steepness of the arc.
Well, it's consistent with the fact that if I take a very small amplitude wave, well, effectively I will need to wait long enough to get. But here, the steepening is in the transverse direction, not in the longitudinal direction. You see, it's still an instability in the transverse direction. So the 20 solar radii in the context of the solar corona are for steepening in the direction of the magnetic field, not in the transverse direction. So I can. I can explain the transformation between tubes and sheets by considering a model which is actually a vector nonlinear Schrödinger equation, and the thing that transforms the topology between tubes and sheets is basically the fact that this term here is not a Laplacian; it's a gradient of the divergence, basically. So. In this equation, this diffraction terms becomes anisotropic, okay, and as the dispersion of my wave becomes small, this anisotropy pops into play, and then I transform the tubes into sheets. So I don't want to go too much into the details, just to remind you.
There's no gradient in that equation?
No, I stopped here. But of course, it's an extension, so you can go further if you want. Let's see here. I will just finish by saying that with directly nonlinear Schrödinger equation, you can look at wave packets. So now, if you start with non-monochromatic waves, you can still observe the filament rotation, but then now the filaments have a finite extent. This is for narrow wave packets in spectral space, and here more wider wave packets. In that case, the filaments take the form of just bubble, magnetic bubble. So the filamentation still takes place. It's quite a robust phenomenon. It doesn't need to be in the ideal context of nonlinear Schrödinger to work. But now the question is to go to the real, full 3D whole MSG equations and see what happens. So in the 3D equations, then you will get, in addition to these pictures of stability, you get a lot of different phenomena. You have, for beta smaller than 1, basically decay instability. Then you have a region of modulational instability here, depending on the wave number. And for higher beta and smaller wave number, long wavelength modulational instability in the longitudinal direction. And filamentation basically appearing between these two lines here. This is a transverse instability. So if I want to look at the transverse instability for right-handed waves, I will look in this region. And basically here are 2 points of numerical simulations we performed. For left-handed waves, the picture is slightly different. The filamentation occurs above this line. And you see that you have here no longitudinal instability, but you have decay plus long wavelength, so decay plus modulational instability below this line. Okay, so this line, this seems to be a good place to study, but actually what happens is that you also get oblique instability in the full equation. So for left-handed waves, you see you have a lot of oblique instability. This is a contour in Fourier space of the instability of the full whole MSG equation. And you see you have a lot of instability in addition to the pure transverse instability. So no hope of really getting something interesting because of the interaction between the different kinds of instability. So we chose to study the case of right-handed waves for beta equal 2.7 and k equal 0.5. And we put this initial condition in the equations. And basically got also tubes, which now look more distorted a little bit because of the interactions between the longitudinal and the transverse modulation instabilities. So this is a cross section of the magnetic field amplitude along the filament, across the filament. So this is for B0 equals 0.1. At later time, this filament breaks, and you see you form a lot of small scale structures all over the place. So we still didn't try to evaluate the heating, but that's something we could do. And also include the...
How do we interpret the field numbers in a situation like this?
Well, you have a mean field, you have this this Alvin waves, plus now the amplitude of these Alvin waves is strong at localized bubbles. So basically the field will become more, instead of being like this, it will have a stronger perpendicular component and localized in small regions of space like this. So when you increase the amplitude of the wave, you get this kind of processes. Filaments break. This was for right-handed, but now if you take... This was for left-handed, but if you take right-handed, then that's where you have now the competition between the longitudinal modulational instability and the filamentation. So you see that you form still filaments, but now they are modulated on large scale here. And in this case, where you have a smaller wavelength, you see that you also feel the modulation at the scale of the Alvin wave wavelength. So in that regime, you have a strong amplification and no competition with the oblique instabilities. These oblique instabilities are completely irrelevant because if they exist, they are at very small scale compared to the scale of the Alvin wave, so they can expect to be dense. Okay, so that's basically one of the parameter regions where we expect to have a good working model for this instability. So right-handed at long wavelengths, and small enough amplitude, you get filaments, and if you increase the amplitude, you will get the sheaves. And so the questions that remain are the question concerning the kinetic effects. So study the limitation and robustness of the envelope equation. So this has been done more or less. Go beyond the singularity. So this was in the context of nonlinear Schrödinger equation. But now study the resulting heating of the plasma. So we have two things to do, which are quite difficult, I think, is to introduce kinetic effects into this equation. It's out of the equation to study Vlasov, for example. Already these simulations are in 120 in cube and take quite a lot of hours because you have to integrate for a long time. Some of the simulations are even 256 squared times 64, I think. So they require a lot of time to compute that. So with Vlasov, it would be out of the equation. We know that in the context of long wave asymptotic, in the context of derivative nonlinear Schrödinger equation, you can incorporate kinetic effects through in the nonlinear sense, for example. This has been done by Diamond and collaborators. It is not known whether this can be done for the MHD equation. This would be kind of the dream of having a fluid model that would incorporate the plasma effects in a simple way. But that would provide us a way of estimating the heating and, as you say, I mean, seeing the competition between this non-collisional effect and this modulational instability. So that's one of the directions that we will maybe pursue in the future. Okay.
Is the in the Gobrik treat-out theory, there's this fact that when you start weak turbulence, you get this cascade naturally approaches strong turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand that the equations are essentially in the weak moment.
Yeah. So one of the messages I have here is that if you start in the weak limit, you cannot stay in the weak limit due to this kind of instability. Basically, these instabilities will drive you, will drive energy from the large to the small scales in a very efficient and quick way. Okay? And so this will be like intermittency on top of the picture of weak turbulence theory. You know? This would provide a very strong mechanism to transfer energy to small scales without going to go through the nonlinear cascade.
Where is the cascade?
Here, in that context, of course, we don't have the cascade. We have just a case where we study a weak perturbation at large scale. We didn't introduce small scale perturbations. But as in the last few transparencies, I showed that if you take a wider wave packet, so basically if you start to consider a case where your spectrum is not delta peaked, but you know kind of wider, then in that case you still have the filamentation process. So you will have both phenomena that will compete. And of course, if you have a Kolmogorov spectrum, I'm not sure that the picture of the filamentation will stay completely unchanged. But I remind you that there are some experiments on nonlinear Schrödinger equations by Newell and Zakharov and Dachenko that show that actually what happens is that you have this weak turbulence with a cascade along the spectrum, and this is this inverse cascade at large scale, and you form a condensate, and this condensate becomes modulationally unstable, and you form very strong concentration, which are the equivalent of this filament here. And this provides a lot of energy dissipation, a lot of intermittency in the picture. So that would be the strong turbulence regime in nonlinear Schrödinger. You see, you have this cascade along the spectrum plus filamentation, I mean modulation and stability on the condensate at last year. So you can have both that coexist. So in the case of optics, as I said, you know, Maxwell's equation are much closer to nonlinear Schrödinger, so that there is almost nothing to do to go from the Maxwell equation to nonlinear Schrödinger equation. So in general, people who study phenomena like this in the context of optics have a very wide range of applicability. I mean, they can carry the application of nonlinear Schrödinger up to very strong amplitude and explain a lot of the features of the lasers. In the context of MHD, the problem is that we couple this dynamics to turbulence, to the fluid equation. So you drive the sound waves. I have not shown at all what happens, but it turns out that this, when you form the filamentation, the sound waves are excited and they start to be ejected and form shocks. So you have a lot of phenomena that can happen that complicate the picture. But one of my messages is that three-dimensionality and can bring a lot of surprises, and that even if you have small amplitude Alvin waves that propagate along the in a homogeneous medium, you can still have a lot of dramatic phenomena happening due to this modulational concentration of energy. So this is a little bit the equivalent of Langmuir turbulence, but this is the equivalent of Langmuir turbulence in a more complicated context, because you have all the hydrodynamics, all these other waves taken into account.
And Jepara proposed the Langmuir turbulence mechanism in the first place to generate ways to take the energy out of long wavelength.
Yeah.
One of the things your model starts at the very beginning with a pressure that's broken the camera. So you've left out in the hydrodynamics where the shocks were formed, you've got a little barrier
pressure. Sure.
So in that way, if shocks are
forming,
are going to be important,
then
that
capture
the energy.
Yeah. Although, you know, as we pointed out already, I mean, the vortices generation is mostly due to curvature effect and to a geometrical effect rather than baroclinic effect, purely baroclinic term. So the grad peak cross grad rho, yeah, which generates vorticity, even though it's zero in the context of a barotropic flow, when you have a strong shock wave which is curved, mm-hmm, you still have formation of vorticity behind the shock, even though it's barotropic. Yes. There is a paper,
Yeah, but I don't think it's the same mechanism, therefore...
It is. It's not. It's concentrated at the shock. It's just the jump conditions that are not...
I'm saying barotropic in terms of density and homogeneity.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I don't see
if you can have, like, when you don't have shock waves, the baroclinic term grad peak plus grad rho create vorticity.
Okay,
I agree with that. And when you have a barotropic flow, you don't have that. But when you have a barotropic flow plus a shock wave, then the jump conditions at the shock waves, when the shock is curved, are such that you create vorticity behind the shock.
Yeah, I realize that, but that's a different mechanism.
Well, I mean, the baroclinic term...
It's a geometric mechanism.
Yeah.
The dynamic mechanism is
in the equation. But in long run, it will be the same. The production of vorticity by the shock will be the same, will be identical. Well, actually, that would be a very nice, very interesting thing to test.
I don't agree with that, but that would be interesting to test. Okay.
You don't agree with that?
No.
Because I think the grad peak cross grad rho, he works, you know, in the...
What would happen if you had a vortex causing a discontinuity or a high curvature in shock? Would you generate a shear layer by your mechanism? I don't think your process, I'd have to look at this.
Yeah.
But how do your process would generate correct shear layers at triple points?
There are more possibilities.
I don't know, I cannot tell you. That would be interesting.